probably the best example of a turning point is when I had the idea to write the Big Book Fact Metaphors. And it was like the immediate imposter voice saying, who the hell do you think you are? You're not a writer. You've never written anything. You're not an ACT expert. Like, you're not the person to write this book. And to be able to observe that story, to understand that this was my mind trying to protect me from humiliating myself, and to do it anyway, because it felt really important to me.
That was Jill Stoddard, and this is Mentally Flexible. Welcome to Mentally Flexible, where we have meaningful conversations to help you build mental flexibility. I'm Tom Parks. I'm a licensed psychotherapist, and in each episode, I'll be talking to people who inspire me most on topics related to psychology, mental health, and creativity. My hope is that through these conversations, you'll better understand yourself, others, and the world around you. Thanks for being here, and I hope you enjoy the podcast. Oh, in time, you'll find your... My guest today is Jill Stoddard. Jill is the founder and director of the Center for Stress and Anxiety Management in San Diego, California. She has a PhD in clinical psychology and specializes in acceptance and commitment therapy, or ACT, for anxiety and related issues. Jill co-hosts a great podcast called Psychologists Off the Clock, which I highly suggest for anyone interested in topics related to ACT. She also is an author and has written two books, including The Big Book of ACT Metaphors and Be Mighty, A Woman's Guide to Liberation from Anxiety, Worry, and Stress Using Mindfulness and Acceptance. In this episode, we explore the role that ACT has played in Jill's personal life, the inspiration for writing her book Be Mighty and unpack anxiety and anxiety disorders. We discuss the story behind Jill's recent TED Talk, and explore the role of imposter syndrome in the writing process. This was a really great conversation, particularly because Jill was willing to be so open and vulnerable. I think you'll resonate with a lot of what we dive into. And thank you all so much for being a part of this podcast. If you'd like to support the show, please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes. This is one of the most helpful ways for me to get new and inspiring guests. And shoot me a follow on Instagram at Mentally Flexible for some bonus content and to occasionally see some cute pictures of my dog. All right. Well, thanks again for being here, everyone. And let's get into the conversation with Jill Stoddard.
Did remember to kick my dogs out. I was recording something for the podcast yesterday and realized after the fact that I had both my French bulldogs snoring up a storm in the background. So,
yeah, I've seen pictures of them. They're cute.
Yeah, though. Thank you. Well, they're gone now. So hopefully they won't start scratching on the door.
Well, yeah, thanks again for doing this. I'm looking forward to talking to you and getting to know you a bit.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Would you start by just giving us a summary of who you are and what you do?
Sure. My name is Jill Stoddard, and I'm a psychologist in San Diego. And I do lots of different things. I'm a clinician. I've been a clinician for a long time, but I'm actually somewhat phasing out that part of my, I guess, wearing a smaller clinician hat, because I'm doing a lot of public speaking. I guess I can say, like, what I'm really about is trying to disseminate acceptance and commitment therapy to as many people as I possibly can, and recognizing that not everyone has the resources or desire necessarily to go see an individual therapist. I like to think about ways to reach the broader public. So podcasts, of course, is one of those ways. So I do a lot of podcast interviews, and then I have a podcast of my own that I co-host that's called Psychologists Off the Clock. And then, like I said, I do speaking. I just did my first TED Talk and do a lot of like teaching and training in the community, both for mental health professionals, but also for the general public as well. And I do still have my clinic. I'm seeing fewer patients, but I have a clinic, the Center for Stress and Anxiety Management, where there's a team of six of us that provide therapy in the community.
Cool. Well, it sounds like acceptance and commitment therapy, or ACT, has really had a big impact on your life to make this a mission of yours.
I mean, that's exactly right. It's really because I have been practicing ACT in my own personal life since I started learning about it as a therapist, and have just seen what a profound impact it's had on me, and, you know, really wanting to share that. And I can't believe I didn't mention, really, like, my biggest passion is writing. So I also write about ACT, and I have two books, The Big Book of ACT Metaphors and another book, Be Mighty, for Women with Anxiety. And so that's, you know, that's one of my favorite creative outlets for trying to share this information with more people.
Is it okay if we get personal on here?
I'm an open book.
What did you struggle with most that ACT positively impacted when it came into your life?
Well, let me be honest. It took a long time, I think, before I was genuinely growing my own psychological flexibility effectively. So I started learning about ACT in graduate school. I was a protocol therapist on a study that Liz Romer and Sue Arcillo were doing on acceptance-based behavioral therapy for generalized anxiety disorder. And even though I was academically learning about ACT and applying it to clients, I think I was actually doing a terrible job of applying it in my own life. And that probably continued through, I don't know, maybe internship, maybe postdoc. And I think it was once I started to, I think during those years, I felt like I was in survival mode. So it was kind of just like learning and doing all the things on the to-do list and getting through the day. And it was once I feel like things kind of freed up a little bit that I could like step back and really look at what was working and what wasn't working. And I think it's impacted me the most in two different areas. One is with my goals, like my professional dreams and aspirations, and, you know, going after things that I normally would not have the courage to go after because it's too scary. You know, the thought of being rejected, being judged, those things would have gotten in my way and I would have lived a much smaller existence. Probably the best example of a turning point is when I had the idea to write The Big Book of ACT Metaphors. And it was like the immediate imposter voice saying, "Who the hell do you think you are? You're not a writer. You've never written anything. You're not an ACT expert. Like, you're not the person to write this book." And to be able to observe that story, to understand that this was my mind trying to protect me from humiliating myself, and to do it anyway, because it felt really important to me. And, you know, then once you're able to do that once or twice or three times, you know, it's like a muscle, like any muscle, that once you start to practice and work it, it starts to get a little bit, easier is not the right word, a little more automatic, even if it's still challenging. So I think that was one sphere, was in my professional life. And then the other is, I have a brother who is, and not a lot of people know about this, but my brother's actually in prison. And when he was arrested, this was probably 8 or 9 years ago now, you know, it tore my family, not tore my family apart, but it just really like devastated my family. And I think because I had at that point been doing a better job of practicing ACT, instead of flipping into this, like the same survival mode that I had used for graduate school, I was able to like adapt and grow. Ultimately, I would say even thrive, because I was able to use ACT skills during that time more effectively.
Wow. Could you speak a little bit more to that? It sounds like that was a huge shockwave through your family. And there was this one sort of path that maybe you would have typically gone down, that survival mode that would have been unhelpful for you. And then something, there was this a way you were able to pivot that was more helpful for you. What was that like?
Well, I think it was so painful. You know, I think it's probably the most intense emotional pain I've really ever experienced. I mean, I've been very lucky that I've had very little, you know, death or big loss in my life. And this was just the most, there were so many emotions because it was completely shocking. Mm-hmm. And then everyone in my family sort of had different ways of coping with what was going on. And we weren't always on the same page. And so there were the intensity level of the pain was high. And then just the various different types of emotions that would show up constantly were more than anything I had experienced as a result of one specific trigger or situation. And, you know, I think in the past, I would have just done everything in my power to shove that down and push it away. And this was a place where I was able to say, like, you can't do that. Like, when I did that in graduate school, I had debilitating migraines that had me in the ER on multiple occasions.
Wow.
And that, like, this is go time, you know, like, you have to respond to this in a different way. And I think also recognizing that, like, this wasn't a singular event that was going to occur and then stop. Like, I think I had a sense that our family was in this for the long haul. And even if having a couple glasses of wine or doing my tendency is to do the, like, go, 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 do, 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 busy, busy, busy to avoid emotion. Mm-hmm. And that while those things might work for an acute painful situation, like, there's no way in hell I can rely on that over the upcoming years that we have ahead of us. And yeah, so I mean, I guess that's really it, is like just kind of like recognizing that the way to go here has to be to have a different way to relate to this pain if you're going to be able to get through this. And I think it also helped that I had a 1-year-old daughter at the time. Or she was maybe 15 months, something like that, and my first child. And so there was this other part of me that recognized, like, you cannot fall apart here. You know, you have to still be able to be your best self, because this is one thing that's happening in your life and in your family. And you also have this, you know, gorgeous, perfect human who has no idea what's going on. And you still have to be able to show up as the, you know, the mom that you want to be.
Yeah. It sounds like you really were able to have a wisdom of being able to step back and see that those go-to ways of making those painful emotions go away in the short term are not very effective in the long haul.
Yeah. And like, you know, I'm not a saint or someone who practices these things perfectly. Of course, I rely on some of those avoidance strategies at some time, at some points too. But, you know, overall, I think really recognizing the importance of that willingness and really letting values be at the center of my decision-making was critically important at that time.
Mm-hmm. I know you wrote a book that, Be Mighty, A Woman's Guide to Liberation from Anxiety, Worry, and Stress Using Mindfulness and Acceptance. When did the inspiration for that book start for you?
So the original inspiration was years ago. I'm not sure how many at this point, but maybe I feel like it was 2016-ish, maybe earlier. And the first thing that came to me was just the title, like Be Mighty just came to me. And I thought, I just want to write kind of a global self-help book, an ACT self-help book that has this like empowerment focus. And what I came to learn is that global books don't work for publishers. Like the way they'll explain it is, and this makes so much sense, is like your audience has to look at a cover of a book and know that they are the audience. So who's the audience for Be Mighty? And so they liked the idea, but they wanted me to like niche it down a little bit. And at that time, it just wasn't quite the book that I wanted to write. And we decided to put it on the back burner for a little bit. And then I had this other experience where I wanted to find some different books for my clients to read. I like to do, you know, when you're only meeting your clients once a week for 50 minutes, I like to give them stuff to do in between sessions. And one of those things is to read really good ACT self-help books. And I wanted a really good ACT self-help book for anxiety. And I thought, and I'm an anxiety specialist. That's what my clinic is for. And I thought, well, I can write that book. You know, why don't I write that book? And there are a couple others out there. And of course, still, even after having written one book, the imposter syndrome still came in, you know, loud and strong.
Oh yeah.
But because I used my ACT skills, I decided to try it anyway. And the publisher liked the idea and we were going to go with that. And then another book, I can't remember now which one it was, but another book came out right around that time that was like a little bit similar. And anyway, I went back to my publisher and said, is this a problem? Like, can we still move forward with this? And it was actually her idea. She said, you know, I have been thinking about what about writing it for women? And at this point, it was probably 2018. I don't know, but it was quite a bit after I had had the initial idea. And it was like in the moment I read that email, I literally got goosebumps all over my body. It was just this moment of like, yes, like this is the book that I was meant to write all along. But when I first had the idea, it wasn't the right timing, because what had happened since then is the United States election in 2016, the Me Too era, the Time's Up era, where like I had really started to explore my own feminism and become much more interested in women's issues and gender bias. And so it was just sort of one of those things where like everything happened as it was meant to happen. It just, the timing needed to be right. And I'm so glad that it unfolded the way that it did.
That's beautiful. It sounds like that, those moments where everything seems to align and there's something deep inside of you that is like telling you that something's spot on. You had that moment with this book.
And I have to say, and this is just occurring to me right this second as we're talking, is, you know, I'm glad that I said no initially when I first had the conversation with the publisher about you need a niche. And I just had this like gut instinct that like, that's not the book I want to write right now. And I'm so glad I said no to that, because I think it would be very tempting that like, well, I mean, hey, if you're being offered a book contract, like just do what they're telling you to do. If writing books is something that you want to do. And I will give credit to ACT for that too, that to really pay attention to my own wisdom and values in terms of making that decision rather than doing it out of this sense of like, you got to take whatever you can get. Yes. If that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes not getting what you want in a particular moment ends up being exactly what you need when you zoom out.
Well said.
Yeah.
Well said.
So when you get this sort of innate knowing that this is writing a book about anxiety for women is what you're going to pursue, where do you begin with that process?
Well, for me, it was kind of starting with, why does this matter? Like, why women? Why anxiety? And, you know, the answer there is right in the statistics that women are diagnosed with anxiety disorders at almost double the rates of men. And that's an interesting statistic, right? You have to stop and think, well, why is that? And if you look around out there to find explanations for that, a lot of what you'll find is, well, men just present differently than women. And men, it's not really that women are twice as anxious. It's that men are drinking or men are being angry. They're not like expressing their anxiety in the same way. I said, well, that doesn't make sense to me, because all the research we've ever done has always favored, you know, white male subjects. It's only in more recent years that we've done a better job of studying other people. So did the researchers just get that all wrong when they initially created the nosology? And I think more importantly, it completely ignores the social and cultural factors of what it means to be a woman living in a still quite patriarchal society. And that when you live in an era where you're, you know, more women are in the workforce than ever before, and more men are doing more at home than ever before, but women are still doing 2/3 of the share of, you know, domestic childcare household. They have 2/3 of that responsibility, even when they're working outside the home, even when they're the primary breadwinners, you know, where there's still this enormous gender pay gap. I mean, I could go on and on. There's research. There's no shortage of research in the ways in which sexism is still rampant. And, you know, like, it seems crazy to think that that wouldn't affect the possibility that women are developing more anxiety because this is the context in which we live.
Hmm. So I guess just to start from first principles here, how do you define anxiety? Like, what is it when you're, you know, what is it when you talk about anxiety?
Well, whenever I talk about anxiety, I like to talk about kind of the anxiety and fear together, because you hear the words used interchangeably all the time and they're close cousins, but somewhat different. And, you know, fear, everyone is familiar with that, like in the moment, acute response, like there is a tiger in your face and you have that immediate fight, flight, or freeze response that often comes with panic symptoms, racing heart, shortness of breath, et cetera. And then anxiety is more of the kind of future oriented, like what's up ahead. So I'm having an experience of anxiety because there might be a tiger up around the bend if I keep walking in this direction. And then worry, of course, is like the cognitive component of that. The like, what if there's a tiger up ahead? What if I keep going and something jumps out and attacks me? And then, you know, stress, which is the other part of the title of the book, right? Anxiety, worry, and stress, I think. also similar, but the way that I've read, the way that I've seen it most commonly differentiated is that stress is a response to a current trigger where there's an, where when you're estimating your ability to cope with that trigger, you're overestimating the level of threat and underestimating your ability to cope with it. And that leads to a stress response, which isn't so different from anxiety, but stress is expected to dissipate when that trigger is no longer present. So like yesterday, I was having a lot of technical issues with a podcast episode that I was trying to publish. And I was physiologically anxious and I was so stressed out about it. And then as soon as the problem was resolved, that whole experience went away.
Yeah.
You know, if this is anxiety, then my anxiety is now latching on to the next thing. Like, is anyone going to listen to it? Are they going to like it? Are they going to judge me? Are they going to judge it? You know, that worry kind of finds something else to latch on to, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So how do you, when does the normal range of anxiety turn into an anxiety disorder for somebody?
Well, so, I mean, there's kind of two answers to this question. Like, one is this whole question of like, what is a disorder, and are disorders even really a thing? Because it's like, we have to have this DSM book so that professionals know how to talk to each other and insurance companies can bill. And, you know, you could have a whole podcast episode on that alone, because of course all of this exists on a continuum and it's not like you have it or you don't. But when I have people in the general public saying, I have anxiety, but I don't know if I need therapy, you know, like, how do I know whether this is that normal level that you're talking about that helps me versus when I've like tipped over into this other space? And, you know, to me, I think that's really about interference. You know, is what you're experiencing preventing you from living a full-sized life? You know, are you living small? Are you staying in a very restricted comfort zone space? But even then, as is the case when you think from an ACT perspective, like it's not really the anxiety that's the problem. It's how is it that you're responding to it that's leading to that more restricted existence.
Yeah, yeah, totally. And even in that smaller, comfortable life, you can, different people can relate to that very differently. And some people that can be a pretty workable thing for them. And for other people, it could be really unworkable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, and one of the other markers I talk to people about is, you know, if you're suddenly having chronic insomnia that you didn't used to have, and I don't mean a night or two here, because we all have poor nights of sleep every now and then, or you're having, you know, GI issues that you didn't used to have that are getting in your way, you know, it certainly makes sense to investigate a little bit to learn how to respond to those things differently. But interestingly, kind of like back to the acceptance and commitment therapy piece is when I look at my own experience, and you know, clients don't like to hear this. I don't necessarily tell everybody this, certainly not in the first session. But I would say, so I've been doing ACT for about 20 years, and I would say that I am more anxious in my life today than I have ever been in my entire life. Even though I'm actually practicing ACT more effectively than I probably ever have been. And the reason for that is because of what I had said before in terms of like, I have become really willing to put myself out there. So, you know, saying yes to a TEDx talk, you know, in my podcast, there are people I want to talk to, people I want to interview. And I think I can't ask this person. They're far too big and important and whatnot, you know, well-known for little old me. And then I reach out to them anyway, you know, knowing that if my application for the TED talk got rejected, I can handle that and I can apply again. If a person doesn't want to talk to me on my podcast, okay, I can make space for that. You know, I can let that sting and then move on. But you know, these are things that are consistent with that mission that we were talking about before that matter so deeply in my heart that I'm willing to do that. But it also means so much more vulnerability. And it means when that guest says yes, and when I get accepted to do that TED talk, well, now I have to do the interview with this person that I'm like massively fangirling over, or I have to actually get, well, it was only a proverbial stage, or it was a metaphorical stage for the TED talk since we're in the pandemic right now. But, you know, and then doing those things, of course, comes with so much more anxiety. But I will also say I simultaneously feel more alive than I have ever felt in my life. And, you know, that's like, that's sort of that trade-off is like, if you're going to really live your values and live big and go for what you want in your life, it might mean feeling more anxious because your anxiety is telling you that like, this is something that really matters to you.
Yeah.
Like if you didn't care about it, you wouldn't feel worried and anxious about it.
Yeah. And you can sort of look at it from two angles. There's the going for something that's important is going to cause a proportionate amount of anxiety, or whatever you have anxiety or fear about, there's a proportionate thing that matters to you or that you should lean into.
100%.
Yeah. Well, tell me more about what that would go on.
Well, I was going to say, and like, isn't that kind of the beauty of ACT is sort of, and when I think about people who find ACT and what they respond to, you know, people in the public who have never heard any of this stuff before, who have had years worth of experience of thinking they're supposed to be trying to feel better, to get rid of the pain. And when I do talks and things, this is one of the things that I think hits people the most powerfully is like, oh, right. If I'm like, I've been thinking I'm supposed to move away from things that make me anxious, but the reason I'm anxious is because that thing matters to me. So why would I move away from the things that matter to me? Yes. You know, it's really, it can be kind of like mind blowing for people.
Yeah. Well, congrats on getting to do a TED talk. I unfortunately didn't get to see it. I'm interested now. Like, tell me more about what that experience was like and what you talked about.
Thank you. Yeah, it's like a professional bucket list item for me.
Yeah.
And it just sort of happened quickly and unexpectedly. Now, I had already kind of put together a rough TED Talk and was planning to apply at some point. Like, I was already kind of in the getting ready phases, and then the pandemic happened, and I just figured I'd wait until we were like back to doing things normally someday. But I was, I actually was tagged on a Facebook post by Lynn Northrup, who's a colleague of ours in the ACBS community. She's another wonderful ACT clinician. And I didn't know why I was tagged. It was this woman, Allison, who I'd never heard of, who was like a nonprofit fundraiser, which is like not remotely in the world that I'm connected to. So I was like, what is this? And I was tagged as well as Janina Scarlett, who's also in our ACBS community and works with me in my anxiety clinic. And Lynn knew that Allison was organizing her first TEDx event and said, you have to talk to Jill and Janina, because Lynn has seen us speak and thought that we would make good TEDx speakers. And it was like, just like unexpected, out of the blue. Like, I had no control over it. I sort of imagined that when the day came that I would apply, it would all be kind of like up to me. Yeah. And I would just do it when I was ready. And so I, you know, it felt like this sign from the universe, kind of like the way the Be Mighty thing happened. And I clicked on the link, and so did Janina, and we both applied to do this. And I thought, well, everybody gets rejected, you know, the first couple of times they try. So I'm not committing to anything by just throwing this application in there. And then we had to give basically like a 5-minute kind of audition type video. So I think we got tagged on a Monday. Applied that day, had to have the audition video in by Friday, which we both turned in Thursday, and found out like later that afternoon that we both got it. And then it was due, because this is all on video now, because there's no in-person stuff. The final video was due 2 weeks after that. So there was like...
Wow.
Pros and cons. The good part was there wasn't months and months to have anticipatory anxiety about it. And yeah. Get all perfectionistic about it. So I reached out to a colleague of mine who does some video work. I really still wanted it to be professional, even though it wasn't going to be the traditional TED experience. But I figured, like, I don't really want my bed in the background of my video, like is the case these days with all the things I'm doing. So I met with him in a studio and practiced, and he videotaped it, and now it's up there. And it was, you know, this is a good example of my anxiety was higher than it's been about a lot of things, and totally worth it. And I think Janina would say the same. And what was really cool, Janina used to be my student way back when, and this was a dream for both of us, and that we got to share it in the same, it's called TEDx Lenox Village Women, in that same event we both got to do our first TEDx. Was really cool and special.
Awesome. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. Tell me more about what you talked about on it.
Oh, right. So the topic was, of course, ACT-based, and it was the part of ACT that's about holding goals lightly. So really talking about how, like, we define success as achieving a goal, but that this is a trap because we don't really control, you know, goals are outcomes, and we don't really control outcomes. What we do control is the steps that we take, like what we bring to the table in terms of what we do and who and how we show up as. And so it's kind of like a values and a holding outcomes lightly talk. And I always talk about values as the me you want to be in this one moment, and how the word me is right in the middle of the word moment. And so it's a nice way to think about, like, when I'm faced with a choice and I can't control the outcome, I can think about who's the me I want to be inside of this moment. I just gave away the punchline of the talk now. The big reveal of the me inside the moment is the very last thing that happens in the talk, but hopefully people will still go watch it.
Oh, definitely everyone go watch it. I'm really excited to watch it. That must have been so... like, yeah, equal parts nerve-wracking and exciting and meaningful and all of that.
All of those things, yeah. And you know what I found too is when these kinds of things happen is The other best part, it's not just this, I have this dream and I was brave and I went for it and it went the way I wanted it to go, which is, you know, the added bonus, even though you can't control that, the whole topic of the talk, but is like how much support ends up showing up and that like you really feel the love from people, like people who know you and know that this is something that matters to you are just like over the moon excited for you. In a way yeah. that by now I feel like it shouldn't catch me by surprise, but it really still does. And I just love having those moments of just kind of like awe and wonder that whether I'm doing something that feels positive, like a TED talk, or whether I'm experiencing something difficult, like, you know, with my brother, is like, you really end up surrounded by the people who really matter to you and like how, I don't know. It's just like this added beauty that happens in these situations that I feel just so grateful for.
Yeah, it's true. It's like on either end of that spectrum, it gives you an opportunity to find out who you're connected with and who's there for you.
Yeah. It's like that connection that feels like it's one of the most important things for us as human beings, you know?
Mm. So to go back to your, I'm curious more about your book. Well, one, I'm even just fascinated in that you wrote a book. That just seems like such a daunting thing to me. I struggle so much with writing, and although I have ideas of wanting to, the actual process of it is so, seems so daunting to me. Were you naturally interested in writing and able to sit down for long periods of time and write, or is that something you had to develop?
I mean, it's an interesting question coming at an interesting time, because I'm working on a proposal for a third book that's about writing, that's like ACT and imposter syndrome and writing.
Mm-hmm. So I've been thinking about the first draft.
Yeah, you want to be a beta reader for me? Yeah. Check it out.
Yeah.
And it's one of the things I love about writing is I find that I learn so much about myself. Like I don't even mean for it to happen, but in the process of writing, I learn about myself and the way people talk about, you know, what happens when they're in psychotherapy. And I never considered myself a writer. And one of the things I was reflecting on is I did take a creative writing class in college. And I got a good grade in it. And I remember an essay I wrote. And I remember the grade I got. And I remember the specific feedback she gave me about this device that I used, like a literary device. And I could not tell you a single grade, feedback, assignment in any other subject I've ever taken.
Mm.
And this just came to me as I was writing this third book, was like, huh, what's that about? Like, I think that there was this writer inside of me a long time ago, and something stopped me from pursuing that at that time. And it's probably too long and complicated to get into what I think might be the thing that stopped me, but it's, you know, kind of like old history type stuff, learning history type stuff. And that it really was only because I had an idea for the Big Book of ACT metaphors that I thought was a good idea that I wrote a book, like not because I was like, I'm a writer and I have to write. It was, this is a good idea and no one's done it. Mm. Maybe I should do it, you know?
Yeah.
And then once I started writing, actually, let me take that back. When I was writing that book, I said to my husband, I'm telling you right now, if I ever tell you that I want another book, that I want to write another book, you remind me of this moment right now where I am telling you, I never want to write another effing book ever again in my entire life. Right. Because it was hard. I had a baby. I was working full time. I didn't know what the heck I was doing.
Yeah.
And then I just kind of like found I think ultimately I enjoyed the writing part of it, even though the process felt difficult at the time. And then, you know, over the preceding or the following years, I found creative writing, and that really, or maybe I should say I rediscovered creative writing that I had found in college, but had buried for a long time. that really felt like it opened up something important in me. Like it became something that I started to crave doing. And by the time I wrote Be Mighty, I already was so clear on what I wanted to write. And honestly, like the book is just, if you read that book, you're basically just sitting in therapy with me. I mean, it's like, I think any of my clients who read this book will be like, oh, this is just all the stuff Jill said to me when we were working together. Mm. So it felt really easy to write. You know, it felt like I was just writing down the stuff I say every day to people that I'm working with one-on-one. But in that time frame, I found some writing podcasts that I love, like Writing Class Radio is one of them. And I started writing essays. But one of the things I talk about in the TED Talk actually is that I was engaging in creative writing for a decade. And, you know, of course, your goal, the outcome that you desire is to get published. And guess how many pieces I had published in 10 years?
How many? One.
And that was in 2020, maybe 2019. The time is so like just runs together now, but it was within the last year or so. Right. And like, this was my example of like, because I was really connected to why I want to write, like it's the creativity. It's like the learning and the skill building and the like trying to develop that talent over time. Like that kept me writing and persisting, even though I wasn't achieving the goal that I wanted to. Whereas like normally you'd see yourself as a total failure as a writer at that point.
Well, that's where I think that we go wrong in the education system is to try to get people to write by having some like one prompt that everyone's forced to write about instead of finding something that like naturally gets a student excited about and then taking that spark to really go with writing.
Absolutely. I mean, it does. It kind of like, it squishes that the creativity. And I hear my little 6-year-old boy coming up with these like super imaginative stories. I'm like, you need to write that down. You know, that'd be a great story. Like go with it. But that's not what the assignment is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right?
But I think to speak to your question where you're saying like, you think about writing, but it feels daunting. Like it makes me wonder if the daunting part is when you're thinking about the finished product. But if you're just sitting down to write for the sake of writing, like for writing's sake, there's not so much that's daunting about it because it's just the experience of doing it. It may be the case that no one ever sees it or it doesn't go anywhere, or maybe it does.
Yeah, I think for me, it's I conflate the writing and the editing at the same time. So I get real perfectionistic in my head and like I'm editing as I write. And it becomes like this really stressful process. And I think that's what I love about being a therapist and podcasting, where I get this one take at just speaking and I can take it or leave it.
Yeah. Well, and part of, at least in my experience, like part of what I've had to figure out over time is what kind of writer am I? Like there's no shortage of advice out there. You know, Stephen King says you have to write every day. I don't write every day. Does that mean I'm not a writer? Maybe. And so for some people, their first draft is just verbal vomit that might be complete gibberish. And then all the editing happens, but that doesn't mean that's like the right way to do it. Lots of people do it the way you're talking about doing it, which is I want to write the best first draft that I possibly can, which means I take more time, you know, really thinking about the right word or how I want to say this. But I think you can use those ACT skills to do that effectively too.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, and then putting it away. And I often find when I come back to things, regardless of which way I did it, because I kind of go back and forth between those, sometimes it's much better than I thought it would be. And sometimes it's much worse than I thought it was, you know, sometimes you just need that space to walk away and come back. And
yeah. And also I like what you said there is like with any endeavor you're going down to really abandon an idea that there's a right way to do something and realize that there's an infinite number of approaches that lead you to an infinite number of outcomes. And sometimes the standard model of how to do something, in this case, writing, often doesn't align with what actually is most helpful for any person.
Yeah. And I think there would be a lot less imposter syndrome around writing if we all had that kind of flexible mentality that like there's lots of right ways to do something and the right way for you is your way. Like whatever your way is. I'm sure not every single published author writes every single day like Stephen King does. They might not admit it out loud because, you know, the king himself said you're supposed to do it this way. But I think the more we can talk about what you're saying, that there are, you know, there are a lot of different, there are infinite ways to do things, and you got to find the way that works for you to be able to engage with something that matters to you. I mean, at the end of the day, it always comes down to flexibility, right?
Yeah. So where are you in the stages of this new book that you're writing?
Well, it feels odd to even talk about it publicly. Like even that is really stirring up a lot of imposter syndrome for me because I'm in the proposal writing process, which means I have no agent, publisher, contract. So it may be something that never even comes to fruition. Yeah. And that, so, you know, like even just saying that out loud brings up all that, like, oh God, now I've told people that I'm doing this and what if it doesn't happen? And yet here I am still talking about it. I had that moment where right before, you know, it happened so fast, I thought, should I say this out loud? Like, should I admit? But you know, the last time I did this is I admitted out loud on a podcast that I had a dream of doing a TED talk. And in that moment, I even admitted like, oh, okay, I'm saying this out loud. It feels weird to put it out in the world because now what if I fail and I'm like all humiliated about it? Mm. And I don't know, maybe putting it out in the universe helps it happen.
Yeah, I mean, that definitely is a thing, right? When you say something out loud, it makes it more real, which then from there, you can relate to that very differently. It can become paralyzing that you made something real, or it can become almost like a guide in the distance that you keep kind of reorienting yourself to.
Yeah. And I do like, I genuinely live that message that I gave in my TED talk of holding outcomes lightly. Like I am going to show up to this process of writing a book proposal and give it my absolute all. I am having a blast doing the writing of the couple chapters in advance that I'll send in with the proposal. I'm like getting some coaching from somebody who's really smart in these areas. So like, basically I'm doing everything in my power to make this thing happen. And at the end of the day, it is up to the agents and the publishers, whether they think that this is, you know, a marketable product, and there's nothing I can do about that. But that uncertainty and that inability to control the outcome isn't, I'm not going to let that affect me moving forward with this thing that I'm like really excited about and having a lot of fun doing.
Oh yeah. I mean, we can so easily get paralyzed by the fear of not getting the, like not having the certainty of the outcome at the end, that it just keeps you stuck. You can get stuck in something for your entire life because of that.
Exactly.
Yeah. And then even if you don't get the outcome along the way of not getting the outcome, you learned so much and you connected with so many new people. And I think about that right now as like, even if I had to give up this podcast today, it's like, I got to talk to Steve Hayes and Kelly Wilson, that's worth it in and of itself.
It still happened. Like that part still happened.
Yes. Yes. And so, yeah, there's like a very helpful reframing that you can do by just recognizing that even the process of not getting the outcome you want has so much richness to it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm. Well, yeah, why don't we end here by just, you can share a little bit more about how people can connect with you and your work and your TED Talk and all that.
Sure. So you can find me at jillstoddard.com, and it's just STODDARD. And on my website, I have all of my social media channels that people can connect with me that way. I actually have a newsletter that I send once, maybe now twice a month, that has content in these areas that we've been talking about to kind of reach the public with some of this. My podcast is Psychologists Off the Clock, and that you can find at any of the places you listen to podcasts or on our website at offtheclockpsych.com. And the TED Talk's on my website too.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Jill. It was great talking to you. I appreciate you doing this.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. Love talking to a fellow podcaster.
Yes, we have to stay united.
Yeah.
That's it. Thank you to Jill, and thank you all for being here and listening. I'll see you next time. Peace.
It's got me out of my mind. It's got me seeing trees breathe. It's got me learning how heaven and hell are both inside of me. It's got me feeling the love that I bottled so deep when the entire world kept feeding on my greed. Try to open my soul.